My name is David Pérez Torres. I am a consultant in intensive care medicine at Hospital Universitario Río Ortega in Valladolid, Spain, and a member of the ESICM Next Committee. Our guest speaker is Professor Arthur Van Zanten. He is an internist intensivist and the chair of the Department of Intensive Care and ICU Research at Gerders Valley Hospital in Ede, the Netherlands. Additionally, he holds a professorship in nutrition and metabolic stress at Wageningen University and Research. In recent years, his focus has shifted towards critical care nutrition, particularly in immune modulating nutrition, protein needs and timing, mitochondrial dysfunction, and refeeding syndrome. Professor Van Zanten is also the new chair of the Feeding, Rehabilitation, Endocrinology, and Metabolism section of the ESICM. Today, we will discuss a very interesting paradigm shift that will occur in the nutrition therapy in the coming years, moving beyond the one-size-fits-all approach to phenotyping and endotyping patients to optimally set nutrition targets. Welcome, everyone. Before we begin, I would kindly ask our listeners to complete the survey after listening to the recording to help us improve the quality of our podcasts. Let's delve into the topic. Could you explain to us what phenotyping and endotyping mean in the context of medical nutrition therapy?
Yes, of course, David. Thank you for the kind introduction. Well, I think at the moment we typically prescribe nutrition in critically ill patients based on like simple factors like body weight or height or maybe in some cases sex. But most of the time, it's what I call a one-size-fits-all approach. So we typically use for proteins the body weight. So we say in the ASPEN guidelines, also adopted by the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine, we have to provide 1.3 grams per kilogram body weight per day. So we just multiply the total body weight times a protein dose, and that's the protein target we have to give to our patients. And the same is maybe for energy. There are many equations, but we know they're all very inaccurate. They're based on population averages. So the average population, average energy expenditure will be okay if you use the equations, but the individual variation is marked. And also during ICU stay, this energy expenditure can, change over time due to so many factors like sedation, fever, recovery, and so on. So I think this one-size-fits-all approach has its limitations, especially because we know that in the early phase of critical illness, maybe overdosing energy, so the kcals we give to the patients or the proteins, has been shown to be associated with worse outcomes, even increased mortality in subgroups of ICU patients. So I think more and more we know now that a more precision medicine approach is necessary. So we cannot use the one-size-fits-all approach every day, the same target for all the patients, the same target, because patients are very different if you compare patients. And also during ICU stay and the recovery, there will be marked differences in the needs for proteins and energy. So what is now phenotyping? I think phenotyping is about, can we better characterize or identify factors in ICU patients that can help us to better target the energy and protein targets. So for instance, we know that patients can have the same body weight, but they can have a large difference in muscle mass or lean body mass. And we think, for instance, that protein dosing should be performed more according to the muscle mass and the organ mass than according to the fat mass, because that's not very necessary to give a lot of proteins for the fat mass. So when you see variations, among patients with exactly the same body weight, we have to consider maybe to more personalize this protein dosing. And the same holds for energy. We know the energy expenditure by patients, although they do not move very much in the ICU, so it's only like the basal metabolic rate, can vary markedly due to all kinds of factors I mentioned before. So by phenotyping the patients, we get a better impression of the individual needs of the patients. And maybe we can discuss later. We use indirect calorimetry to know a little bit more about energy expenditure, and we use bioelectrical impedance assessment to dissect the body into its components and to better target the protein dosing. So I think that's the next step. The next step that can be used also to reflect the metabolism of the patients, because that's another issue. We can give a very exact dose of energy and proteins to the patient, but what is the metabolic fate of the macronutrients or micronutrients we give to the patient? And that's more about what I call endotyping. So if we give the same amount of proteins and energy to a specific ICU patients that has exactly the same body composition and exactly the same energy expenditure, it can still be that the proteins are not used for muscle protein synthesis, but are maybe discarded and well metabolized into breakdown products. So that's more endotyping. So can we monitor the metabolism to know whether what we give is really utilized, is used for the right ways in the body of an ICU patient? So that's the next step, and even more complex than phenotyping.
Okay, these concepts really seem promising. They are challenging to implement, however. So from your perspective, what are the main limitations of current clinical practice in this area, and how should we drive the change to the phenotyping and endotyping in critical care nutrition?
Well, yes, of course, there are barriers here. And I think most important is maybe the importance of critical care nutrition and the awareness that one size fits all is not the way to go forward, that we can do harm with nutrition and we can do benefit to our patients. So if we understand that, it should also be something we have to consider as intensivists in Europe or globally. So it's not only a matter of inviting dietitians to take care of the nutrition of our patients or having it performed by ICU nurses. I think as doctors, we have to consider it's part of the full treatment of our patients, as important as mechanical ventilation or circulatory management. But to go from a one-size-fits-all strategy, just to use like equations, and to go into phenotyping or endotyping, we need something more. And I think the first step is equipment. So in the ASPEN guidelines, we have to recommend that ICU patients, at least a ventilated ICU patient, should be monitored using indirect calorimetry to know what is the individual resting energy expenditure. And I know the uptake of this kind of devices is still very slow. And I think if you consider that we have so many monitoring devices in the ICU, that this one is not very expensive and can be very easily performed. So it's not difficult. It can be used in most ICU patients. And another device we use is bioelectrical impedance assessment. Some units use ultrasound of muscles. That can also be a technique to get an estimate of the lean body mass, of the muscle mass of patients. But I think most important is we need champions. So doctors, dietitians, or nurses that say, well, feeding is important for our ICU patients in ICU and also after ICU during the recovery phase, because we can improve the functional outcomes of our patients. And we do not want to do harm by giving overfeeding or too high protein dosages to patients in the early phase. So I think that's important. And you have to invest in some some equipment to go to the next step. And maybe you should also monitor some biomarkers for endotyping. We can come discuss maybe later. But it takes a little bit of investment. But if you divide the total cost involved by doing this by the days of your patients in ICU, the daily costs are very, very low. So much lower than maybe 5 to 10 euros per day. And I think what we do in ICU is so expensive, we spend thousands of euros per day. And by, well, optimizing nutritional intake, I believe strongly we can make a difference in the patients. And especially we want to prevent to do harm with nutrition. And that's something you can probably only monitor by using these kind of techniques to individually monitor your patient.
We have, unfortunately, no biomarkers to guide energy intake during critical illness and recovery in the clinical setting. But maybe, as you said, indirect calorimetry may be a reasonable option to guide nutrition therapy. So you gave us some important reasons to convince clinicians and hospital managers of its utility, but what's the information that indirect calorimetry can provide to the clinician? And is there any evidence that it saves lives or improves outcomes?
Yes, that's an excellent question. So first of all, we have to consider it's a measuring device that measures resting energy expenditure of the patient. And well, that can in some instances be the same as what you have to give to the patients, but in some situations you should not follow the readings of indirect calorimetry. So it's important to know when to use this information of indirect calorimetry. I will give some examples. So in the early phase of critical illness, we have to gradually progress to the target, because there is a lot of endogenous energy production by glycogen breakdown in the liver and also fat, lipolysis, so the production of free fatty acids, and there is protein breakdown. And this is due to the catabolic response of the patients. And normally when you start eating or give feeding and insulin, you will stop this process. You will immediately stop the breakdown of your body stores. But it does not happen in ICU patients. They keep on breaking down the body stores, and especially in the first few days of ICU admission, there can be a large amount of endogenous energy production that's non-inhibitable by feeding. So when we give the full nutrition dose in the first few days, we get overfeeding. So this is the reason that in our hospital, we have a gradually build-up schedule of 25% of the target per day. So in 4 or 5 days, we are at the 100% target. So that's the first step. When you measure indirect calorimetry on day one and you have a reading of 2,000 kcals energy expenditure in this patient, you should not give 2,000 patients, but maybe 500, and then progress over the days to this target. And then repeat indirect calorimetry to know what is the next energy expenditure, and we use that every 3 days. And by doing this, we follow the needs of the patients over time. A second reason not to give everything you get from the indirect calorimetry device is refeeding syndrome. So when you see refeeding hypophosphatemia in the early phase after the start of enteral or parenteral nutrition, or even non-intentional calories, so from propofol, citrate, or dextrose, glucose, you have to restrict the calories to 500 kcals per day for 48 hours and then gradually progress to the targets while you take care of the electrolyte abnormalities in refeeding syndrome. So it's not always that you have to give what you measure. But there are some randomized control trials. However, the randomized control trials individually did not meet a difference in mortality or clinical endpoints that were significant. There were strong trends, but when you look at the meta-analysis, there are indications that it can reduce mortality in ICU patients when you give energy and target your energy prescription in ICU following the guidance of indirect calorimetry. And I think that's an important message. In the early phase, it's preventing overfeeding by indirect calorimetry. In a later phase, we have seen, especially among COVID-19 patients, that the energy expenditure in the second and third week after ICU admission can be very high. So then we should go maybe to 3,000, 3,500 kcals in individual patients. And probably using equations, you will never give this. So then you have underfeeding in a later phase. So I think there is a good basis for this. And if you calculate the cost, the healthcare cost associated with overfeeding and underfeeding, especially leading to infectious morbidity by overfeeding, for instance, and we can prevent this, we save a lot of money. And there have been calculations performed by the group of Professor De Waele in Brussels, suggesting that when you target this and you prevent this adverse effects of under and overfeeding, that you even have a benefit in terms of healthcare costs in the ICU. So I think more and more data is emerging that shows that guiding your nutrition strategy by indirect calorimetry can help to improve the outcomes of the patients, to reduce morbidity, mainly infections, and also mortality when we look at the meta-analysis. But it can also save healthcare costs when you already have included the cost for the investment in the device and the disposable. So I think there's not a real good reason not to implement indirect calorimetry in your ICU.
Okay, that was really informative. Let's now focus on specific nutrients. Adequate protein intake is crucial for muscle mass, immune function, and wound healing in critically ill patients. And we are familiar with weight-based recommendations for our patients depending on the phase of illness, but these phases are poorly defined in real practice. So from your perspective, how should we individualize the protein strategy with phenotyping?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We do a lot of research on this, and I think, this topic is on the move. We see more groups in the world now being very interested in individualizing protein dosing, because we have seen the effort protein target by Professor Hyland recently showing that a very high protein intake targeting at a protein intake of 2.2 grams per kilogram body weight per day, and they achieved around 1.6, was not better with respect to outcomes in that study than a lower or more dose into the guideline range, around 1.2 grams per gram per kilogram body weight per day. But in the subgroup of those patients with high SOFA scores and AKI, so renal failure in the ICU, they have shown harm. So I think high protein dosing can be riskful for some individual patients in the ICU, while probably there is also a lower limit. So when we go maybe very low, below 0.8 grams per kilogram body weight, there are indications that it's, well, a too low dose for ICU patients. But how can we know how many proteins we should give? I think from a more metabolic perspective, I think proteins are important for organs and for muscles, because our protein stores, our main stores, are the muscles. And every day, muscles are regenerated, or they're broken down and they're regenerated by 1 to 2% per day. And during critical illness, the breakdown is enhanced. So there's more breakdown. So we need substrate to rebuild our muscles. And that we can do by giving proteins. And when they're digested and absorbed, like dipeptides or amino acids, the amino acids in the blood will go to the organs and go to the muscles, and they form the substrate for new muscle protein synthesis. And there is a problem there, because we also have so-called anabolic resistance. So all the proteins we give during critical illness cannot be utilized fully, but we can discuss that later. But the first step is to know what is the muscle and organ mass of the patients. And we can do this by measuring the body composition, because the total body weight cannot really very well reflect the muscle mass of individual patients. So during COVID, we had two male persons of 100 kilograms, and they had an individual difference in muscle mass of about 30 kilograms. So one was more like a bodybuilder type, and the other was a slightly obese patient with a very low muscle mass. That's called sarcopenic obesity. So I believe that the patient with this very low muscle mass needs less proteins per day than the patient who is very muscular with a large muscle mass. So we did studies to address this using bioelectrical impedance assessment to dissect the body in its components and to know the lean body mass or the fat-free mass. So that's everything except for the fat mass. So I think the important mass for the protein targeting. And what we've seen in this study, and we only have preliminary data at this moment, that we saw when you meet the protein target based on the individual lean body mass of the patient by more than 90%, the muscle mass loss in ICU is very limited, only a few kilograms. But when it's 80 to 90% or less than 80% of the target, we see huge muscle mass loss up to, well, 10 to 13 kilograms in those patients. And when we do the same associations and we take the total body mass of the patients, we find no association. So I think some of the studies who shed light on protein dosing and outcome in ICU are maybe confounded by large difference in muscle mass. So I would recommend in the future to use phenotyping and to target protein dosing more on the lean body mass of the patients. And that's what we are doing right now in our ICU. We do bioelectrical impedance assessment every 3 days in our ICU patients, and we stopped using total body weight for the equations, 1.3 gram per kilogram body weight, but now we use 1.85 grams per fat-free mass, so lean body mass. So then you need another recommendation, 1.85 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass. And we believe that's more individualized, so that's better, dosing proteins according to phenotyping of your individual patients. And I think that's probably the way to go forward, to have a more individualized approach for patients dosing proteins. And this may also potentially prevent protein overdosing and inducing harm in subgroups of patients in the ICU.
Okay, we have discussed about phenotyping with a very interesting approach in your ICU. Have there been any recent advances in endotyping to evaluate protein needs? Is there any way to assess the role of autophagy in a patient with a critical illness at a specific time point?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Well, because when we have very well defined the phenotyping of the patients and give individual protein dosing according to the muscle mass, we are not completely there. We need also endotyping. So endotyping is more, what is the metabolic fate of the proteins we give to the patients? Can all the proteins we give and the amino acids be used for metabolic processes like muscle protein synthesis? And one of the processes we know in the early phase that can be suppressed is autophagy. This was maybe one of the factors that was shown to be involved in worse outcomes of patients in the IPANIC trial, the parenteral nutrition study, studying early versus late parenteral nutrition. And in the early PN group, there was harm, so more morbidity, organ failure, and a lower likelihood of being discharged alive from the ICU. So we now start supplemental parenteral nutrition later, maybe after some days or at the end of the first week. And experimental studies by this group in Leuven showed that probably suppression of autophagy was one of the main reasons for this negative effect. And autophagy is a cleaning mechanism in cells. So we have normally the proteasome ubiquitin system to, well, discard small proteins and break them down into the components and to reutilize the nitrogen from the protein. So it's a recycling process, and it's, well, boosted or enhanced by starvation, by not giving nutrition. So that's recycling. But we can suppress this by giving a lot of feeding, especially proteins. At this moment, I'm not aware of a test that really can be used as a biomarker for autophagy. We have some blood markers for autophagy, but I think that's more for experimental projects to use. But maybe there is one other biomarker that can reflect the utilization of proteins. So when proteins are not used in the body for organs or muscle protein synthesis, they will be metabolized and discarded via ammonia into urea. We have a urea cycle. So what you could see in the blood of patients that cannot handle the proteins is a change in the ratio of urea, blood urea nitrogen, and creatinine. Because creatinine is a kidney function, as we all know. But when you have a stable kidney function, the creatinine levels reflect the total muscle mass. So when you have a lot of muscles, you will see a slightly higher creatinine level. And when it's low, it could reflect muscle mass loss or sarcopenia in your patients, if you wish. But when the ratio goes up, this, well, involves also already the renal function. So an increase in urea suggests that proteins are not utilized. And we have the EAT ICU study also giving a lot of proteins to the patient, and they calculated that 60% of the proteins given to the patients were not used for muscle protein synthesis, but were discarded as urea. And urea to creatinine ratio is very simple, because we measure creatinine every day, and now we also started to measure blood urea nitrogen every day, and we have in the computer this ratio available in all our patients. And what is interesting to see, and we've observed this now in many patients, that the moment you see an increase in inflammation, so when the patient has a line sepsis or a ventilator-associated pneumonia, again, after CRP levels have dropped, after the initial admission diagnosis, you see an increase in CRP levels again. After this second increase, we saw again an increase in UCR, urea creatinine ratio, for in some patients 7 to 10 days, suggesting that after an inflammatory response, because I believe it's driven by cytokines, by inflammation, we see an increase in this UCR, suggesting that after an inflammatory re-challenge, the metabolism or endotyping, the metabolism is not able to handle the full protein dose. Now, at this moment, we don't know whether we should reduce the protein intake at that moment to do no harm, but it's very likely from a metabolic perspective. At least it's not very helpful to give a lot of proteins during this episode, because most of the proteins then are not used, but discarded as urea. So I think when we have more work, and there are now indications, because at least 2 studies have shown that there is an association between this urea creatinine ratio, a biomarker for protein endotyping, is associated with worst outcomes. So the first study is the REDOX trial that was performed to study high-dose glutamine supplementation in ICU and published by Darren Hyland in the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago. And there was harm induced by giving the high-dose glutamine to patients. But now they did a reanalysis of this study and also measured or calculated the urea creatinine ratio. And they found that the patient with a high UCR had a higher likelihood of morbidity and mortality in that study. So it suggests that the glutamine did mainly harm in those patients that could not handle the glutamine as an amino acid. And secondly, there has been performed a post hoc analysis of the EFFORT protein trial, also by Professor Hyland, that suggested that, this high UCR was especially also present in the patients that were harmed by the protein arm, so the 2.2 grams per kg per day groups in this study. And then it's also understandable that patients with a high SOFA score, so a very high inflammatory status, were not able to handle a high protein dose, and also those patients with emerging AKI, so with renal failure, because then you cannot handle the breakdown products of proteins like urea. And what is also interesting, I've seen recent data that those patients who were on dialysis, this effect was not seen. So it suggests that when you could take care of the high urea production by proteins, the effect on, well, worse outcome can be limited by dialysis techniques. And also maybe because when you use, for instance, renal replacement therapy like CVVH, you remove some of the proteins into the ultrafiltrate by convective elimination. So the actual protein dose in these patients is slightly lower. So I think we are in early phase now, but it could be that urea creatinine ratio is a promising biomarker that can, well, follow endotyping and to look at the metabolic fate of protein administration in ICU patients. But I think more work has to be done in this field.
Okay, so another hot topic in this field is the personalization of micronutrient management. Do we have another opportunity for improvement with phenotyping and endotyping here?
Well, I think this field is maybe the most challenging because we don't have very, very good biomarkers. And the problem is when we measure the plasma status of micronutrients like vitamins or trace elements, they do not reflect the total body stores of these micronutrients. It's maybe the same as albumin. You can see albumin dropping in ICU patients in hours, and it is not, the production of albumin, but it's, extravasation of albumin due to capillary leakage. And the same holds for micronutrients like vitamins and trace elements. The moment there is an inflammatory response, we see that the protein binding of micronutrients can be affected. There is leakage to the interstitial space. And that does not mean that we have a shortage or deficiency in the micronutrients, but what we measure in the plasma is lower. And for instance, if we look at selenium, the moment there is inflammation and there is need for antioxidant, increase in capacity, selenium will be built into selenoproteins that, can adhere to the endothelium, for instance, of blood vessels. So a drop in selenium levels can also be something adaptive and very beneficial because the selenium is used in the processes. Processes where it's intended for. So to measure only plasma levels of micronutrients is very, not so informative of the total plasma or the total body stores of these micronutrients. And so the way to go forward is maybe to use downstream biomarkers, but it's complex. So you could measure like antioxidant status. Is that reduced? And that could be an indication to maybe increase selenium or vitamin C or vitamin E. But still, that's very challenging. Another way to go forward is to look at intracellular levels of these vitamins or trace elements. And this can be done in blood cells like erythrocytes or leukocytes. And this week I was at a PhD defense in Rotterdam where they measured this in children. So they took plasma samples, measured the micronutrients and also intracellular levels. And they found that although the plasma levels were 50% of normal, the intracellular levels were normal or even a little bit higher. So there seemed to be a switch of where the micronutrients are. So for now, I'm not aware of many, metabolic, useful biomarkers for endotyping or phenotyping micronutrients. So the only thing then we can do is to do intervention studies. But the intervention studies have not shown any benefit when I review all the data available. So we've seen many studies on vitamin C. And recently, even in the Lovett trial, there was harm by high-dose vitamin C. But then the vitamin C is given like 8 to 12 grams to patients. So that's supraphysiological dosing of micronutrients. And I think that's something else than supplementing a slightly lower dose or an insufficient nutrition dose. And that's what we do. So we give micronutrients to all our patients in the early phase of ICU stay, but not grams of proteins or vitamins or trace elements, but just the recommended daily allowances. So what we need as humans to stay in a good condition, we have exact data of the RDAs for all the micronutrients. But you have to consider when you start your enteral nutrition in a patient and you build this up in 4 or 5 days, in the enteral nutrition products, there is not enough of the micronutrients, because typically in 1500 ml of tube feeding or 1500 kcals of tube feeding, there will be about enough of these micronutrients. But when you build up in the first few days, this dosage will not be enough. So for that reason, we start with IV micronutrient solutions or multivitamin and trace elements. And on day two, we try to go to a more oral product because it's cheaper. And we dissolve this in water and give by enteral feeding tube, until the patients at the moment of meeting the 1500 ml enteral feeding target. And as you probably will know, in parenteral nutrition, there is no micronutrient. So we have to add this always, but we do it separately, because also for parenteral nutrition, we have to gradually build up to the target. So when you dissolve all the micronutrients in the PN bag and you give only half of the bag, you only give half of the dose of the recommended daily allowances to the patient. So we give this as a separate infusion, like the multivitamins and the multi-trace element product. It can be given as a separate infusion, and then we can just build up the PN in steps like EN. So this is at the moment what we do in our ICU with micronutrients. And actually, we are waiting to have good biomarkers to know which patients have a deficiency that can be monitored by maybe downstream metabolic pathway indicators. But for now, it's very difficult to know whether is a patient in ICU has a deficiency.
All the strategies we have discussed are thought-provoking. So what barriers do we need to overcome to achieve personalized nutritional targets in critical illness?
Yes, as always, as we change our routines, there will be barriers, people that do not believe it's helpful. So I think, first of all, we have to create awareness for critical care nutrition in general, that it's important, that it's as important as other aspects of critical care medicine, like ventilation, antibiotics, circulation management. I think nutrition and monitoring metabolism in ICU patients is as important as any other modality of our treatment. So I think it could also be made a little bit more interesting when we move from the one-size-fits-all strategy to more like phenotyping and endotyping. Because then, like we are used to as intensivists, we monitor something in our patient, we measure something, and according to those measurements, we implement what we do with the measurement results. So I learned also in our ICU that there was some reluctance to perform indirect calorimetry and to perform the bioelectrical impedance assessment measurements for the patients. But the moment we changed our patient data management system in the ICU, and the nurses were able to insert the data they had measured and saw that our electronic, well, prescription system for nutrition immediately changes to another prescription of enteral or parenteral nutrition, they felt more confident that what they were doing, were measuring, is important. So as always in an ICU, if you request some equipment to be used, but you don't do anything with the data, then it's not very easy to implement such a technique. But as we, well, have this system in place now, and the nurses can see the moment they change something with respect what they have measured by indirect calorimetry or by BIAA, and it leads to another prescription of the nutrition therapy, it's very helpful. And of course, we have to convince our colleagues, maybe less interested in nutrition, or hospital administrators to show them that it's important and that the amount of equipment investment is not so very big. The workload is very limited. So you can just connect indirect calorimetry to the ventilation system near the Y piece of mechanical ventilation of the tubing system. And like BIA measurements are even more fast than making an electrocardiogram. So it's not that complex. But of course, we have to do a lot of education, how to interpret these data and not do the wrong things with the data. I already alluded to the fact that when you have indirect calorimetry measurements and you have refeeding syndrome, or you are in the very early phase of critical illness, you should not give what you measure. So there's also importance for good education for our medical staff, our nursing staff, and also the dietitians. But having this kind of systems in place opens a new world. And in our ICU, it's really exciting. And we see now also we can make a difference in patients. Sometimes we've seen that patients get so many non-nutritional calories by propofol citrate and other of this is non-nutritional calories that there is no place for feeding any longer. And I've never seen that before until you start measuring this. And we've seen that in some patients we were overfeeding by 20 grams of proteins, and another patient where we were underdosing 30 grams of proteins in individual patients. So when you see this happening in your own ICU, it makes you enthusiastic. And of course, we need champions. We need researchers to advocate and recommend this kind of strategies. And we need more scientific data, of course, also to prove that these kind of strategies make a difference with respect to outcome. But I think we're very near the point that we all will leave the one-size-fits-all strategy and go to more phenotypical-based prescription of nutrition. And the next step, of course, is endotyping, but that's more complex. What is the metabolic fate of our nutrients in ICU patients during all the phases of ICU stay? Because also in later phases, maybe you can go higher than what you measure with indirect calorimetry, because patients have to start exercising. They have to rebuild the tissues. They have to regain muscle mass. And maybe then you have to give a little bit more of energy and proteins than what you measure by indirect calorimetry or by bioelectrical impedance assessment. So we have to learn a lot more how to do this, because ICU stay and recovery from critical illness is a dynamic process and all the patients are different. So it's a really exciting and challenging field, but I think in the future we will see many more studies and also guideline recommendations with respect to this.
Excellent. So that's really thought-provoking, yeah. So what do you think at the future perspective in these fields?
Well, I already see that there is a lot of interest in this more phenotyping, endotyping approach, because the one-size-fits-all approach did not lead to any well, improvement in outcomes. Maybe we know a little bit better what is harmful for patients. That's like maybe similar to mechanical ventilation. We know that we should not give high tidal volumes. Now we know we should not overfeed the patients in the early phase. But exactly what is the individual optimum for a patient, we have to learn. And more, well, groups, research groups and expert centers in the world are now adopting this kind of approach. So I think we will move far away from this one-size-fits-all approach. And I hope also we started with the process of making a revision of the ASPEN Adult ICU Nutrition Guidelines. I'm one of the guideline makers. And we hope also to have some aspects of this individualization strategy into the new guidelines. We expect them to be ready in 1 or 1.5 years. So I think this will be a major change from where we were in the past, and we move on into this direction. But it will take, as always, a long time for this will be adopted by all ICUs. We know from other interventions that it can sometimes take 5 to 10 years because before a broad, well, implementation is realized. And for that, we need a lot of attention in medical congresses, maybe this kind of podcast or webinars to address these topics and to keep on telling the news that we have to change gears into this new direction.
Okay, so what would be your take-home message for our listeners then?
Well, the take-home messages are critical care nutrition is crucial, is essential for our patients. You can do harm by overfeeding patients with early high energy intake. You can harm patients and some patient groups by giving too high dosages of proteins. And a one-size-fits-all approach is not the way to go forward because patients are individually different from other patients. And also during the course of their ICU stay and convalescence, they have different needs, both for energy, so kcals, and also for protein intake. So I think the next step is to go to phenotyping to better identify the individual needs of our patients based on body composition, energy expenditure. And the next step will be also to monitor the metabolism of our patients to know whether what we give to the patients is utilized by metabolism and is not discarded, for instance, the proteins into urea, because then it's not helpful and maybe also dangerous and harmful for our patients. So I think this is my, well, depiction of the future, and we will see many publications on this and probably also lectures in the future on ESICM congresses.
Thank you to our appreciated speaker, and thank you all for listening to us. Have a nice day.